This is the Past Lives Podcast, episode 200, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at the Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And I want to say a big thank you to all of you for listening to this podcast. This is episode 200, and I could not have got this far without your support. And I'm looking forward to producing more episodes over the coming months and years. And I have a new type of episode for this podcast called Paranormal Stories, and I'm going to continue releasing new episodes every Thursday, and I hope you like it. And this is the free one-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is an hour and 22 minutes, and to get the extra 22 minutes and the other extended versions of the episodes, you can join the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I release new episodes every Monday. And you can find it on almost every podcast app. There is also a new $12.50 Patreon tier, where every week you can get the extended episodes of the Past Lives Podcast and the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes. And there are now 44 extended episodes available to the $5 patrons. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/Past Lives Podcast, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. Also, when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you're a patron, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call which can be booked on my website. The links are in the show notes, and you can find the show notes for this and every other episode on my website. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, will be your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week I'm talking to Bud Megagee about his book Soul Afterlife Beyond the Near-Death Experience. Bud is an award-winning author of 5 unconventional memoirs that survey the potential existence of a world of souls. He is the CEO of the Megagee Healthcare Group, specialising in developing behavioural health medical intervention and transformation strategies. Bud has said he will give away a free download of his book from Audible to the first 5 listeners who send their email addresses to him. And his web address is in the show notes. Hi, Bud. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Simon, thanks so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
So I wanted to ask you to come on because you've written so many great books. And the book I wanted to talk to you about is called Soul Afterlife, Beyond the Near-Death Experience. So could you tell us how you got into all this stuff, how you got interested?
Yeah, I think it's just to back up, I could just a little bit for you. The entering into the world of souls is not something that I felt was in my original life plan. As a matter of fact, if you had my friends and family around for this podcast, they would probably tell you I was the least likely individual to kind of get involved in all that. But I give you a little bit of the backdrop of it and a little history of how it led me to that place and time. For a living, I ran psychiatric hospitals on a national scale in the States here. And in the course of all that, it's over a course of about 40 years. And then while doing all that, particularly during the latter 80s and into the 90s and 2000, the way in which many of these hospitals and programs branded themselves was that they were the kinds of interactive experiences with people with emotional challenges could experience treatment attention to the mind, body, and soul of the individual. And when you look at it on the face value of that, regarding the mind, I mean, there's a lot of very interesting and worthwhile therapies that people engage in that help people out. On the body, with the onslaught of psychotropic medications within the 50s, 60s, and 70s, regardless how one may feel about that, they do, in fact, have the ability to alleviate some of the suffering that some patients feel. On the soul or spirit side of it, however, it was a little lighter, I guess, in terms of how they really attended to that portion of the patient's experience. oftentimes, and I mean this with all respect to everybody who's ever worked with me in any hospital I've ever been involved in, more often than not, the spiritual soul part of an experience was perhaps a local minister coming in on Sunday to attend to whatever needs the patient population felt that they had at that time. And for many, many years, that seemed to be, not entirely, but for the most part, the way in which the institutional operations went. It wasn't until, I guess, in the early 2000s, that I ran across some very conscientious staff who really challenged that issue. And they challenged it more from a professional standpoint than from a religious or even a paranormal point of view. When somebody comes into a hospital like that and they engage with the patients, they really should be medically, clear to do that. And in essence, credentialed. And many of the physicians I was working at that time were asking about that in terms of the people that were coming in to do that kind of work on the Sunday afternoons. They also need to be able to have an engagement with the patients that were charted in the patient chart so that come Monday morning, people knew what transpired over the course of the weekend. So it became more of a challenge, I think, of, well, if we do something different than that, what really should we be doing? Time passed after that, and I happened to be studying at a Buddhist monastery in Northern Virginia. I became very good friends with the abbot there. And I was really kind of searching for, from an Eastern philosophical standpoint, are there things that they do that really start the attention to the mind, body, and spirit portion of the patient population we're still dealing with? And there are some things in terms of meditation and relaxation, mindfulness, etc. But I have, and you can see this in the books, I have a tendency to ask an enormous amount of questions about things, just in terms of trying to learn everything I can learn about. The abbot there, he's actually in the book a little bit, in the Afterlife book, he said to me, his name's Kenshin. And Kenshin said to me, you ask a lot of questions about this, particularly on the spiritual soul side. And in the Buddhist tradition, they have a doctrine they call anatma, which is a no self, no soul, which is kind of different from many of the religious philosophical points of view about what we are as a body of energy, so to speak. And he says, and you have a lot of conflict with the doctrine as well. And he says, sometimes in life, particularly when you want to deal with this aspect of the soul, sometimes you need to find special resources for that. Or those special resources seem to find you in terms of finding your answers for all this. And I remember his last comment to that day saying to me that, from your point of view, but perhaps you need to go to the source. Your questions are so complex in terms of how you're going to take this information and transfer it to what you do professionally. It wasn't that long after that I had stumbled really across an individual who has a very high profile practice up in the mountain regions of northeastern Pennsylvania. And I had an engagement with this individual, this woman, because she had also studied and spent an enormous amount of time studying a Buddhist monastery. And that was kind of what connected us together. And it was during that time that as we would have these conversations about a wide variety of issues, and just one evening when we were talking, she said, and she is a medium, psychic, oracle, whatever terminology you want to put on all that. She said, it's really interesting, Bud, you have a guest this evening here. And that guest happened to transpire into an energy, you want to call it, a being, a guide, so to speak. That is very personal to me. And over the course of the next 8 years, I journaled and cataloged my interviewing experiences with somebody who, on the face of it, seemed to know me better than I know myself. And I posed that question in the first book that I did, if you were sitting in front of somebody who knew you better than you know yourself, what questions would you be asking? Whether you believe in this phenomenon or not, what questions would you be asking, knowing that you would get the most honest answer in return? And the only payment that you had to make for that was that you had to be honest in terms of the responses you had back, because there was nowhere to hide. And so over the course of 8 years, I've taken this expedition into the world of souls, which I won't get into the first four books, but eventually ended up with an interest on my part in terms of what really happens after we pass. And we can talk a bit about that, and I'm sure your listeners have, and some of the other podcast guests you have had on your program. There's a wide variety of ways of kind of looking at that, you know. We can certainly look at it medically. There are a lot of research in terms of what's being said or not being said in the whole medical community about what happens when somebody passes. There's a wide variety of religious dogmas we could examine, including the Buddhist pieces. On the literary side, there's an enormous amount of books that are being written all over about, you know, what can and can't happen, including some of the stuff you've had on your podcast. I was a big fan of Michael Newton and his life after life stuff. It kind of settled me a little bit when I first read that book. There's the NDE experience. And I have a lot of faith in terms of the storylines behind what happens there, how people are courageous enough to tell their stories. And then there's the mystical part, you know, the part with the guide that I interacted with, or any mediums or psychic individuals, and how they perceive that portion of the world. The one thing about all of those things, because as Kinchin has said to me, in order to find a real answer, maybe you need to go to the source of it. Well, I assume that you and I could agree that there really isn't any definitive source on any of it. You know, it ends up, and I get challenged a lot about this in terms of, you know, having my experiences that are translated through surrogates and proxies, essentially a guide and a psychic oracle named Shola. Now, regardless of what way you get your information, you're left with this dilemma. Do you believe the message? Do you believe the messenger, or the form in which the message came to you? I found it extraordinary in terms of the message, and perhaps because you've done me the favor of reading Afterlife. When you read Afterlife, you can see I'm challenged about the whole book. I question everything, and still do, even till today, question a lot. Because I think that makes for a healthy expedition to a world that none of us really know verbatim, you know. Kenshin has a quote he gives me every time I see him. I don't see him very often recently, but every time I walk into the door, he says, "Quid potus, quid paetus. What do you seek this time, bud? Which itch are you scratching? Which stone is in your shoe?" So the Afterlife book itself, we'll get into this a little bit. It gets into a different perception of the afterlife. And I want to be candid with both you and your listeners up front, and the world of souls, because I think you can't have one without the other. It's also one man's journey of discovery about the world of souls. And you can see that in terms of the way the book's laid out. It's laid out in a narrative fashion. It is verbatim what transpired between me and the discussion. And it shows what it's like to have an interaction with an energy that prescribes to be one of your personal guides. So that's the backdrop of how I came to do this and how I came to eventually have this book published. But perhaps maybe we could start, if you had some questions, at least initially having read it yourself, and we can go from there.
You have the transcripts of your conversations with possibly one of your spirit guides called Laz, is that correct?
Yeah.
And it's coming through somebody, is it Sherlett Enema?
Yeah, that's I get asked that question a lot. Yes, Laz was a name we gave him. He doesn't have a name per se. And that's something I learned about the world of souls. I'll tell you a funny story in a minute. But We gave him the word Lazarus because he didn't exist for a period of time, and he seemed to rise up from the dead one evening when Flynn Shirlette and I were having a discussion. So, but he says, his name is a vibration. And he says, we are the only, not species, but humans are the only ones that use names to define a lot of things. But I will tell you a story that when that first occurred to me, I wasn't taken aback. I'm not an advocate for spiritual exchanges. I don't want to see things. I don't want to hear them off my own. I use Shirlette as a proxy because she's more attuned to that. And I'll get into a little bit of her talent in a minute. But after the first exchange, I didn't know what to do. So, and maybe your listeners will understand this. I Googled when you come across a spirit guide, what should you do? And it said things like, you know, you should ask, does it have a name? And what connection does he or she or it have with you? And et cetera, et cetera. So for the first several meetings that we had together, that I kind of went down that path until it was kind of turned on its head, so to speak, because the intention behind his connection with me was based upon his mission with me, which is his job, for lack of a better term, is to attend to my spiritual development. And as I've learned over time, from his point of view, my spiritual development had gone off the rails, and it was his connection to try to kind of get me back on track, so to speak. From Shirlette's point of view, I actually asked Laz one time what his how he connects to Shirlette, because I'm not overly familiar with the whole aspect of channeling. I've never examined that from another perspective. But I will tell you this: I mean, Shirlette doesn't transform into anything. She doesn't voices don't change, all that kind of thing. It's just like having a conversation. We tape everything. We have 8 years worth of tapes about all of this. But I did take, and it was recently this past year, I did ask Laz. I said, I get a lot of questions about how you as a guide actually make this connection. He said to me, he said, Shirlette's a vessel. He says, I'm feeding her energy, and that results in her ability to both see and hear me. He described mediums and psychics and channelers, etc., this way to me. He said, everybody has that talent, you and I have heard that before, that we're all born with that talent, but only a few have the ability to really access them. I said, well, why is there a differentiation between all that? And he said, because it's like everybody has gone to the water's edge, and some people have psychic ability to the extent that they can put their toe in the water. Others can go up to their knees, others up to their waist. And he said, then there are the ones like the woman sitting across from you, and she's completely submerged in the water. So she not only sees and hears us, all of us, but she's able to kind of make this kind of connection without her energy burning off. He says, I'm a perceptioner. I'm giving her the perception that I want her to see and hear. And then she can relate that to you, much like he said, you would be tuning into a computer. He said to me, just for your information, bud, he said, members of your family and your associates have never seen me. He says, but your dog has seen me, because when I'm around. He says, for you, I create the perception of what I looked like in our past life together so that you would understand me better. And I found that really interesting because, I don't know much about channeling, but it would make sense to me that if somebody was making a connection, a communication connection, it would be so specific that I would understand it. And I will tell you this, Simon, after my first encounter, I looked at Shirlette and I said, it's really interesting. It's like I was talking to my brother sitting across the breakfast table here. And I guess that's what he was doing, was making his persona such that I would be able to more clearly identify, who he was and et cetera. And he said, I don't possess Shirlette. He said, that would hurt her. Other channelers potentially connect with, a lower energy.
He says, but guides possess energy that is so raw, it would be dangerous for someone with a low vibration. For example, he says, if a higher energy enters a human shell, it can literally break the shell. The other energies that are being channeled could be family members or distant family members or something else, but he says, but clearly not a guide. So that's the connection between all that and what she does and what she doesn't do. But I've told this in other interviews I've had, it's still not unusual for me to, go and visit with Charlotte, and I'm still looking around for cameras and microphones and other kinds of things, because it does teeter on grossly unconventional, And we've often toyed with the idea, we really should, if there's a capability of filming something like this so that people could understand what's happening here, it'd be a unique experience. So that's the backdrop.
Okay.
Regarding the afterlife, that tends to be, it's a topic that everybody has an interest in, and I've had a lot of review of NDEs, and in particular with the Division of Perceptual Studies down at the University of Virginia, and Dr. Stevenson, Grayson, and Tucker and that group, and an awful lot of data that can be really philosophically and academically examined now. A lot of it falls into the category of post near-death similarities, how people's lives change, etc. The one thing that really didn't trouble me, but the one thing I asked myself was, but so many of the NDEs are not identical. They're very almost individual unique, with some similarities laced in between all of that. I wonder why that is. And it's interesting, because when you look at it through that lens, you begin to wonder where is the line between what is real and what is imagined, and what you and I think is eccentric? Because it seems to me that it should be a simple question to answer. If you can see it and you can hear and you can touch it, then it must be right. Yeah, it must be real, right? But what if this way of thinking limits our ability to look beyond what's obvious and to view our existence with new eyes? And I kept thinking about that as we were examining the near-death things. We'd all like to think that the ongoing story of the universe is a tale about human imagination. It's sort of like a romantic narrative with the capacity to take seriously everything that we see before us, just might not be exactly the way that we understand it. As an example of what I'm talking about, I had a person the other day, and this may apply to you as well, Simon. I had a person the other day refer to me as a spiritual anthropologist. I was really curious about that. He says, because you're asking what it's like to live in somebody else's world. In a way, it's kind of become like your moral campus, this specialized effort you're undertaking. And you would think about anthropologists, they're the curious ones among us. And truthfully, from time to time, in addition to being very skillful and meddlesome at times, at the end of the day, it is understandable about all of that, because they recognize that they meticulously probe everything. And as I think about this whole world of spirituality that we enter into, I can't help but go there with it. We want answers to everything. And for an anthropologist, after all, they're seeking the most primitive of all answers, right? Simon, what is it like to walk in somebody else's shoes? So from an afterlife perspective, what is it really like there? And to borrow Kenshin's thing, what source do you have, or do any of us have, to kind of get that answer? So somehow, I see my expedition into the world of souls as equivalent to that, and almost like an anthropologist of sorts. Because I also become curious whenever I'm confronted with a clouded view of an alternative world I can't really tangibly see or feel or hear. That is why I find myself with very few solid answers while exploring the world of souls. And that's indicated in the book. Yeah. But also, you know, I'm learning it all through the imaginings of somebody else. And that's why in the end, it was imperative that I search out really others, surrogates, proxies, whatever you want to refer to them as, the system plotting. What is the required route that's necessary to find the answers of what really, what kind of things could be possible? Is it more than what we imagined it to be? Is it more than what we've been told it is? I was raised a heavy duty Roman Catholic. So, and that's kind of indicated throughout the book of how I get challenged with many of the scenarios that Laz lays out, including those that begin to challenge any of one of our perceptions of multiple lives or soul splitting. And we can get into that if you'd like. In the end, I had a friend of mine say, you know, from a psychological standpoint, to get back to what drove me to this, I had a friend say, you know, one of the benefits, if we can really kind of solve this conundrum here, is that when people come in for a form of attention to a healing of an emotional conflicted issue, it is as though they have a small circular pocket mirror that has been dropped on the ground and shattered into, 100 pieces. And because we can attend to the mind and body of that, we can kind of glue that mirror back together. And so we can make the mirror whole. But the problem is when they look in the mirror, they see it as a taped together and glued together mirror. And he said, it seems to me that only through our ability and attention to address the issue of spirit or soul of the individual, will that mirror ever become clear again. And so that was really the genesis behind all this.
Hello, listeners. This is Simon. Now, as some of you know, I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom, and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyze what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. The first chapter is called The Octopus Analogy.
Yeah, there's a lot behind the octopus analogy, isn't there? And having read the book, you know that he goes on later in the book to kind of give a more concrete rationale behind why he uses a odd sea creature to describe what the afterlife may be. And I will tell you this, Simon, the octopus analogy was really introduced two or three books ago, just as almost like an introduction. And I'm finding after 8 years, some of the things that I'm educated on are given in small little nuggets, if you will, and built upon over time. And as I told you earlier, before we started, that even since this book, he's added even more on top of the octopus analogy. But here's what he says, and again, kind of get into the meat of this. He says that when a soul is born, and he's not all that interested in educating me on that, but I did ask. He said that when the soul was born, they're attracted based upon the vibration and frequency of the newly born souls into a cluster, a small cluster. And And that becomes their learning group, so to speak. And I said, are you always in a cluster? He says, yes, you're in a cluster, but as your frequencies and vibrations rise over time, based upon your incarnation, you may move from cluster to cluster to cluster, you know, in a world of familiarity. But the head of the octopus is described in the analogy as that's the housing unit, for lack of a better term, of, he says, 3, 4, 5, 6 groups of souls at a time, all with a similar but not identical interest in mission. And he says, as a new soul, you would drop one appendage, one learning incarnation, and you would take the majority of your energy to that incarnation and go to the furthest tip of that tentacle, and you begin to have your experiences. And based upon your experiences, you would move up that tentacle and then back into the head of the octopus. And over time, as a more advancing soul, you would drop 3, 4, or 5 different tentacles. He talks about, and this was kind of a controversial thing because it was very contrary to a lot of NDE research. Because I asked him about it, I had had more conversations with NDE people than others prior. He said, NDE experiences, and I certainly don't mean to be offensive when I say this. He says, they walk along the perimeter of the afterlife. He said, you enter the full complexity of an afterlife when your soul splits. He says, the reason that they don't see or relate what's in the book is, he says, because from an NDE perspective, they haven't, from a spiritual perspective, died yet. You know, what's interesting, as I just said that, throughout my experience with him, he oftentimes relates to my confusion of it all. He says, one of the things that you hurdles you have, but is your ego. It's not so much that it gets in the way, he says, but a human ego never really lets anybody fully embrace or understand what happens spiritually. He said, what happens in our spiritual world is radically different what happens from a human perspective. Because I was very conflicted over the thought of, what do you mean my soul splits? What does that mean? And he said, well, you are of the original creation which split. So you are a mini version of that. So as a soul, as you begin to evolve, you drop more and more tentacles, all with the same purpose, so to speak, the same mission, if you will. Here's a question I'll ask you. I tend to ask a lot of people this question because it was asked of me. He said, if you could choose one word to describe your purpose right now, what would that word be?
It would be to learn, I suppose. That's why we come here, isn't it? Incarnations is to learn.
Yeah, I had no answer when he asked me, because I'm in the middle of this exchange between Charlotte and Les. I had no answer because I've never been asked that. But if that is the answer, right, then the mission, the life purpose, if you will, of that soul, Simon, would be to learn everything he can learn about learning, both the yin and yang, both the positive and negative. And Laz would say, I'm not meaning speaking with him, I'm kind of reiterating what he said to me. How many lives do you think that will take in order for him to learn everything he needs to learn? For me, he said, because I didn't have an answer, he says, Bud, you, in this iteration of you, you're a healer. Your healing is not of people right now, it's of the institutions that treat people. He says, so if you look at the octopus analogy for you, Bud McCarthy, there is an energy in the head of the octopus that is more than you can possibly imagine. So there's an energy in the head of Simon's octopus that is more than he can possibly fathom. But he does have one appendage that is Simon, the podcast guy. There's Bud McGargy, the hospital administrator guy. That's one of my appendages. But I may have others. I may have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different appendages, all learning different aspects, the yin and yang of being a healer. So let's take I'll use myself as an example. Let's take the Bud McGargy tentacle, the Bud McGargy portion of energy tentacle. And he's had multiple incarnations on that tentacle, all in an effort to kind of that portion of his energy to learn what he can. In some instances, he may have been doctor. In some, he may have been administrator. In others, he may have been patient. And as he learns, and if he learns and he's aware, he moves up the tentacle as he becomes, you hear the term higher self, as he becomes more aligned with the higher version of that portion of the energy. It isn't until that tentacle completes all of its learning through all of its incarnations that that portion of the energy goes into the head of the octopus. But if you had, let's say you have 6 tentacles, Simon, then all of the versions of your energy on all those missions and becoming a learner had to be completed over all those incarnations until all of you retreated back into the head of the octopus. And then at that time, that energy, he says, is amazing. He says, you can't comprehend your energy at that point in time. And at that point, your energy may decide to do something entirely different in terms of what it wants to do, either moving on to other octopus heads or taking on other kinds of responsibilities, as an example, like a guide. The reason he uses the octopus analogy as the analogy, and we did this, I think it's in one of the latter chapters of the Aftermath book. And he says he finds it interesting that we view the octopus, the sea creature, in a certain fashion as something that swims in the ocean and that we eat as a delicacy. He said, but the ancients saw it very differently. And he says, I find it ironic that the octopus never questions what it could do. It can grow an appendage. It can recreate its environment for protection. He said, that's similar to when all of your energy is in the head of the octopus. You feel that way. There's nothing you can't do. I found it interesting that he kind of looped it back in terms of the rationale behind why he used that as his focal point of analysis. Does that all make sense to you?
Yeah. I know some of the background to it, of course, because I've read that first chapter. But there's things in that first chapter that stood out for me, ideas that I haven't heard much of before, if at all. One of them is this idea that the individual soul develops multiple variations of an incarnation. So that could mean there's tens or hundreds of me or you. So that could mean there's multiple universes.
Yeah, it gets very complex. I mean, I didn't want to lose myself in it as it was being explained to me, but that's why what I get in terms of the 8-year learning are nuggets along the way so that I can at least attempt to digest it. You know, I mean, I even say in the book, there's an awful lot that appeals to me intellectually, but I have a hard time grasping emotionally. And as a result, it kind of still lingers out there in front of me. Not only that, but I mean, to understand it, I think, and this is his challenge to me, is he says, the understanding is that you are an energy. He says, and as a human, he says, we have a tendency to think in a linear fashion. And so that the only, your energy is only what you see is like a block of energy. That there's a block of Simon energy. There's a block of Bud energy. And so that block moves into an afterlife, and that block stays intact in the afterlife, and that block kind of reassesses itself and reincarnates as a block. He said that couldn't be further from the truth. He says, if you think of energy, energy flows all the time. He says, you can walk by, and these examples are in the book. He says, you know, you can walk by somebody and touch them on the shoulder, and you've dropped little energy there. You just haven't, you're not aware yet to know that that happened or that happened to you. You can touch a table and you've left a little bit of your energy there. Your energy is all over the place. And he gets into that a little bit in more in finer detail. I think the analogy that made a lot of sense to me, at least intellectually, was he said, imagine a person picks up two pillows. He says, what does that person usually tell you about those pillows? He says, they'll tell you about the shape, the color, the fabric, et cetera, et cetera. He says, but it'd be very rare that someone would say to you, you know, I think a person that was really smart and of a genius level picked up this pillow sometime and some of this energy is on him. He says, we're just not tuned into that. And he doesn't, he's not anti-ego, but he kind of says emphatically that when the ego kind of takes hold of the determination of what is real for us, we kind of lose our perspective of the spirituality of everything.
It's interesting, also another thing he says about, this is what I thought he was talking about. I thought he was talking about when you have multiple incarnations of the same life, so there's lots of different Simons out there. When one of them dies, they don't just go back to the head of the octopus or move up the tentacle. They move to one of the other lives, which are still active, to help the other incarnations help in their learning.
Yeah, he was very specific with that. I had a hard time with that. But it is explained a little bit more as you move through the book, and it explained a little bit more as I moved on to the latest book we're writing. But I had a hard time with that because I think I even mentioned the book. I don't understand that. I mean, so you're telling me I'm not who I am. And what he said was this. He says, let me give you an example, Bud, of one of your other tentacles. I said, okay. He said, one of your other tentacles passed. He says, let's call it tentacle number 6. That tentacle passed, and it passed about 10 years ago. He says, but not in your time zone, in its own time zone. If that makes sense to you, right? He said, but that tentacle passed. That tentacle was a monk in the Peruvian rural area. He says, now, isn't it ironic, Bud, that that's when you started your activity at the monastery? That that's when you started going to the monastery. He said, a portion of that monk's energy flowed to you, and that's why you got that. Not the entirety of that monk's energy. So I had a misunderstanding when it was first explained to me, because I had it exactly as you just explained it. You mean to tell me all my energy kind of rolls over to an appendage? He later came back and said, no, but because your energy is flowing, it's not an intact block of energy, a portion that is capable of going over to an appendage. Because the rest of your energy, or the lion's share, let's call it, of that energy, of the Simon energy or the Bud McGuarty energy, begins to go through what he called the 7 senses. And that was moved on to chapter 2.
Yeah, yeah. I got so many questions.
I know. I'm talking to you, and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I still have questions about that one too, you know. But that's, again, it demonstrates two things. It demonstrates that as your soul kind of expands, I guess, I rather feel more comfortable saying that it expands in terms of what it is rather than it fragments in terms of what it is. But just for your listener's perspective, what he says is that, you know, your energy then addresses the 7 senses of the soul. They being these, love, fear, peace, hate. What he calls the God connection, but it's not like, it's like the wanting to ascend. The area of karmic events, and a sense he calls the overseer. So it is going through those 7 senses And I think I even clarified it in the book to him, Simon, if he clarified it to me, that you go through those seven senses separately as an energy. It's not like it's getting away from the linear perspective of a soul energy. It's not like all of your energy, the Simon energy, goes first to love. And then after that, it goes to fear. But what he says is that you split off in terms of percentages of your energy based upon your vibration and frequency that you achieved when you were alive. So that what made sense to me about that was he says the first one you encounter, your energy encounters, is that of love. And he says that's why so many who have NDE experiences, that's what they experience first. He says when you pass, it's like an opening up, I guess, of everything. And mostly, he said, what you initially experience are aura attachments, or attachments to your aura, the memories that you have of the past life, of that life. Sometimes it's your religious beliefs, sometimes it's revisiting some of your past lives. He says, but love is, he says, that's why people, they attach themselves to husbands, wives, children, grandparents, parents, et cetera, et cetera. That's that part of your energy attaches to that part of your life experience. Fear he described as is kind of more caution, that the soul is unsure of itself. So it tends to go to an area that's familiar. And oftentimes it'll go to the environment that was familiar, which would be this lifeline. He said the peace is a higher... but a higher aspiration, I guess, of what the soul is looking for. He said, hate is he says, everybody has it, every soul has it. He says, it's not the favorite portion of a soul. He says, but all of us have had experiences that were unpopular for us. And he said, the fear of that is that as a soul now, you're powerful. And that can sometimes end up with some, he calls them hauntings, but he says there's no such thing as ghosts, but he says they're like a haunting. He said the God connection is the willingness, the understanding now that I can ascend to something bigger than myself. And then he says that the area of karmic events, he says that's where we pay the price for what we've done, both good and bad. And in the book, he draws any one of a number of different scenarios of, you know, if you beat somebody up on the playground, what happens at that time is that during a karmic event is you're feeling that. You're feeling now what you've done. But as having read the book, you also know now, Simon, too, you also hear every thought that you had or thought about you during that period of time as well. And he says that can be, any one of those can be a traumatic experience for a soul. And then he talks about the seventh one, which is the overseer. He describes it as a referee. He says the overseer's role, that portion of your energy's role, is to make sure that all of those energies come back together in a single form of Bud McGargy or Simon energy, so that you can now begin the process of thinking about reincarnation. I had a hard time with that chapter, to be honest with you.
There was something else I wanted to ask you about with reincarnation. I've heard a little bit about, but Laz says, this is what he says in the book, the reincarnation can put you anywhere within time. It could put you at 1913 or 1000 BC or 350 AD, or it could put you on a different planet or within a different universe. So it's saying that reincarnation is not just this linear thing where you just life after life.
Yeah, he's kind of relentless about that in the book, isn't he? Especially, I think he addresses that issue of time, you know, on multiple occasions, that there is no time. I mean, time is our thing. It's not his thing. And he actually makes a reference that when you are a whole energy, meaning that all of your tentacles have been completed and you're now back in the head of the energy as a full intact energy, that in order to reincarnate, you have to have access to the past, present, and future. Because you know it all then, you know. So the past, because you had, that's where your learnings are, your soul learnings are. The present is what the most recent experiences you've had, and now you're kind of looking down the pipe towards, you know, what I may need to do going forward in the future. It's a kind of a delineation between space-time and time-space, you know, that when you're over there, you have access to all three of those zones. Whereas while we're in this life, the only time we have is the now. You know, we don't have access to, direct access to past or future. So, yeah, he spends a lot of time on reincarnation, didn't he? You know, about what goes into that. I think what was most interesting, and if any of your readers kind of pick up the book and et cetera, I take a lot of questions from people about all of that. One of the things that it doesn't trouble me, but I have ongoing questions about all of this, because in the midst of, you know, the words he uses and the stories he tells us, or the analogies he uses, or the hoaxes that he kind of lays at my feet sometimes, it's the scope of it, I think, is what can be a little numbing, I think, because we like to think. I mean, at one point in the book, he says, you know, to think that when somebody passes, everybody here thinks they're now one intact body of energy now in heaven, when in fact only a small portion of their energy is. Right? That how many, he says, how many of you left at the same time, because now you're split into so many different aspects of it, that in order to try to address the complexity of the incarnation you had while you were here. Now, on the face of it, you know, being, I'm not a Buddhist per se, I mean, I follow a lot of their traditions, but the one tradition that kind of stays in my mind all the time is that they have two that I keep in my head. One is that we're far more than we think we are. You know, I think that that's really kind of what Laz is saying in so many ways, is that if you have the awareness of it and the information about it, it becomes easier to navigate. You know, he makes a reference in the book that so many of us are, he says, there's so many of us here that are, we're younger souls. And now he gets into that. It's not, I didn't transcribe this. He begins to get into that a little bit with me in this regard. It's not that we're, we've had like one incarnation or two incarnations. He said, it's that you may be in the same spot on that tentacle over and over and over again. So you're young in that regard. You're not progressing up the tentacle in such a way. And he refers to that as having incarnation loops. You know, and he says that the biggest prohibitor to that is our inability to become aware of the information that there's more to it than that. He doesn't blame things, because he says, as you've read, he says there's no time, so you can learn whatever you want, whenever you want to learn it. It's not like you're on a on the clock, so to speak, to kind of find out how you learn all these things. I found it interesting. I'll go right to the end of the book for a little bit for you, because at the end, he gave me two signs. One was an old key, antique key, and the other one was a reef. And I think in his conclusion, he says the old key represents awareness. That's awareness and balance is really kind of what gets you through not only your incarnations, but as you plan to address your incarnations before you leave, and as you begin the process of developing your new incarnations before you leave. One that was struck me was the wreath, however, and he said that the wreath represented everything. It's never ending. It just keeps going. He made the analogy, if you remember this, he said an octopus is like a college within the university. So if you look at it through that lens, so we have within our university, we can be learners, healers, teachers, artisans, warriors, you know, any one of a number of things that we could experience as a soul. And so in each of those colleges, you have a number of incarnations that could, who knows what the limit of that is, to learn everything there is to learn about. And it's our awareness of that that allows us to progress. Use an analogy in a book about someone being being born, having an incarnation in medieval times, and he was a sword maker, and he was a really good sword maker. And he dies, and he goes on, and his soul gets cleansed, and he goes through the seven senses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And his new incarnation is going to be born back again as an artisan, but his responsibilities now will be to build beautiful structures. But because of his lack of awareness, he's still in his basement making swords. And he used that as an analogy to say, if we don't have the awareness of the vastness of what's available to us, then it's difficult for us to move forward. And he goes on to say that, you know, so many souls nowadays are simply in a loop. They're simply looping in the same incarnation. And he says sometimes with the same people, just over and over and over again. But if you look at it from the university standpoint, he said, imagine all of the possibilities of all of the things you can experience being octopuses that are hanging tentacle to tentacle covering the entire universe. And that's your job, is to go through all of that. And I said to him, it staggered me. I said, how many incarnations are we talking about? And he says, it just goes on. It never stops. And I found that fascinating, you know, because one of the things that when you get down, at least for me, when you get down this road of an expedition into the world of souls, you begin to think about what is the purpose, right? What is the purpose of the incarnation? Or if there's multiple incarnations, what's the purpose of that? If this is as expansive as Laz articulates, what is the purpose behind that? And he says, and in so many words, he says, because that's the way it's always been. So, in the Buddhist tradition, we have what we call brilliant sanity, which is the understanding that at our basic level, we know exactly who we are. And when you get introduced to information like this, it kind of makes for a little bit of turbulent times in terms of trying to understand really who I am at this point. As I learned through the book, and I'm not settled with this, I learned through the book is that there is some truth to the fact that with balance and awareness, a lot of things do get resolved. You know, in the end, Kenshin says to me that my Buddhist friend, he says, it's in the silence. He says, it's in the silence and the breath. The understanding comes to you intuitively. As to who you really know you are, once you can remove your ego. And the Buddhists think the ego is a giant dictatorship designed to force us to not be able to learn with a sense of awareness and certainty.
We're almost out of time. We've been talking about your book, Soul Afterlife, Beyond the Near-Death Experience. But can you tell us about your other books?
Yeah, we have two that we're working on now. Soul Afterlife was 2020, I guess, published 2021. The one we're working on now is the a continuation. I think I mentioned you offline that we get so many inquiries about the octopus analogy that we've decided that I did convince all of them up in Pennsylvania that we needed to kind of address that in more detail. But the one we're working on right now is called The Afterlife Experience, how our association with nature's elements really participates in the shaping of its outcome. You know, the premise basically being we are made up of the elements. We are the elements. The elements are us. And how we do or don't exchange, interact with all of that can have an outcome. And then the one that's, we're hoping for 2022 for that. I know we're about 80% through with that, I would guess, give or take. We're hoping that that happens. And then the one that we want to do after that is the octopus analogy, how it connects to everything.
And so you've got other books out and they're all on Amazon, aren't they? People can get them Kindle and can they get them other places?
Anywhere, Goodreads, they're all over the place. The Afterlife alone is in both paper, hardback, and audiobook. I like audio. I like audiobooks. I like the fact that someone's actually talking to me sometimes, you know, rather than I get lost in the reading of it. But Afterlife's in all four formats.
And do you have a website people can find you on?
Yeah, budmcgorgy.com. And it certainly gives you a little summary of not only the Afterlife book, but also all the other four, and a little bit about a little background on me and what we're trying to accomplish for them.
Well, it's been really great talking to you. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you, Simon. I really do appreciate your time and effort. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Bud McGorgy about his book, Soul Afterlife, Beyond the Near-Death Experience. And remember, Bud has said he will give away a free download of his book from Audible to the first 5 listeners who send their email address to him. And his website address is in the show notes. And a great way to support this podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And this is the free 1-hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 22 minutes. So if you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you will have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. Also, if you're a patron, you get a 25% discount when you book a past life regression session with me. And please check out my new podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I'll be releasing new episodes every Monday, and you can find it on almost every app. There is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group, and if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.